Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Family Business Radio broadcast. We are here every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m., and we hope that you will always continue to join in with us. You know, through Family Business Radio, we are here to showcase family businesses, and we're building a community that's designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am your co-host, Pat Rombletti from Sage Executive Search.
And I am Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management. How are you, Pat?
I'm good. Good to be back. We took a week off for the first time, so it's good to be back in the saddle.
I know, but we had a great taping of a previous episode that we had done with Sarah Burden, and I thought it was really topical. It kind of tied a lot of the things we've talked about in the past, so I don't feel too guilty about being on.
No, it was excellent.
Well, I want to get us started today, and we have, as always, a very special broadcast. But today we're going to be looking at angel investing from really two viewpoints. Number one, how can you diversify your family's wealth by becoming an angel investor? And number two, we've had a lot of bankers on, so with banks saying no and private equity sometimes, you know, being an option, sometimes it's not, that means it's really a loss of your autonomy. So can an angel investor come in and be a good source of capital to help grow your business? And that's what we're going to really delve into today.
We are, and we have two fabulous people to help us cover that topic. First, I want to introduce everyone to Michael Blake. Welcome, Michael.
Hi.
Michael has I know Michael by, well, actually three identities, but one I'll keep secret, but two for sure that I know. Michael, you are currently director?
Director of Valuation Services at Habiff, Arrigany & Wynn, and we're the largest independent accounting firm in the Southeast. And that, in English, that means I figure out what stuff is worth.
Yeah, I noticed many of the credentials, and one of the things that you do is long-lived asset impairment testing.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have to have a separate show on that,
yeah,
I think.
Sounds exciting.
And radios are being turned off all across the regions, folks.
But a much more, I know, a very exciting piece of what you do is Startup Lounge. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Startup Lounge is a 501c6 nonprofit entity, and our mission is to serve as an advocacy platform for the venture-driven entrepreneurial community in Georgia. And we have our own podcast with about 20,000 subscribers. Just goes to show you anything can go on the internet. 2,000 companies. We've gotten 10 or 11 companies funded through the Startup Lounge network. And later this year, we're actually expanding into other states. So it's a lot of fun. We're basically a bunch of communists. We believe that networking for capital should be free. You shouldn't have to pay to pitch. You shouldn't have to pay for introductions. You shouldn't have to pay for knowledge. You shouldn't have to pay for education. All that should be a professional courtesy, and that's what we do.
That's excellent. Absolutely excellent. And I noticed that you and Meredith have followed a couple of paths together. You also were a finalist for the TurkNet Foundation Award and one of the 40 Under 40. But I know you don't qualify for that anymore.
I don't qualify for either, probably.
Well, I went to your birthday party, so I know about the 40 under 40.
He's an old man, like you say.
And Karen, our other guest is Karen Robinson Cope, and we built her here and on our website as a serial entrepreneur and philanthropist. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
You know, Karen, I noticed that your early career started out long before entrepreneur in a much more corporate setting. Can you tell us a little bit about those early days?
Absolutely. When I graduated in the early 80s, there weren't many jobs available, so I went into the retail industry. And what's great about that is you have tremendous responsibility early on. But quickly I realized that that's not what my call was. So I was recruited into AT&T, did some executive management there, and then was recruited into small companies. And since that, I've been in a number of privately held earlier stage companies.
And sold a few of those?
Absolutely. Sold the last one to a Canadian public company about 4 years ago. Again, has had just a terrific, Atlanta's been good to me, and Atlanta's been, I think, good to the startup community.
And just to make sure that as our listeners are tuning in and we get to the part about raising money, I know you have some distinctions about the amount of money that you were able to raise during your career. Share those numbers just so everybody knows that you are an expert.
As CEO of a number of early stage companies that range everything from technology to what I call the dark side, media. Mm-hmm. I've raised probably $70 to $80 million of startup capital as CEO, which, again, is a fair amount, but especially when you're from Atlanta, Georgia.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to put in a plug here. We had a guest earlier this year, Maxine Burton, who was a member of the Committee of 200. And I'm mentioning that because I hope that our listeners out there, particularly the women listening, will go and Google that and look up a little bit about it. It's quite a profound organization. And talk a little bit about your participation in that.
We were one of the first class in the late 90s for the mentor program. And they picked they chose five of the most promising women in the country who they felt that they could provide mentorship. Mentoring services too. It was a great program. But just to segue from there, the Atlanta community is so warm toward women entrepreneurs, and not from a financial perspective, but in terms of the women themselves, have been so encouraging. They are truly are, I would call it a sisterhood. And then you have every so once in a while those token males like Michael that are there to help us out. So again, it's a great place to be a woman entrepreneur.
Yeah, I would concur with that.
Well, you know, Mike, I know we were talking and we've talked about Startup Lounge, but I know it's really been a labor of love for you. Can you talk to us, what has drawn you to working with these early stage companies?
You know, I have a degree in finance, and I grew up in a financial environment. My mother was a banker. My father ran the valuation practice for Ernst & Young in North America for 25 years. But I made a decision early on of being in finance, and this is with the help of actually a teacher of mine, that I wanted to be in an area of finance where you can actually make a difference. And most of finance, frankly, is about taking a cut off of somebody else's transaction. And that's fine. Like, you need that to make an economy work, but that's not what I'm about. And when I was a little kid, when I was in high school, I used to tell people I wanted to be an investment banker, thinking that that was a banker who actually made investments into things. And only later, when I was in my early 20s, I realized that's called a venture capitalist. And so I got into venture capital very early because it's an area of finance where you create things, you're building stuff. And I was fortunate to live abroad. I spent a number of years in the former Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, working with entrepreneurs, and they were working under such horrendous conditions, you know, hyperinflation, you know, literally paying for lunch with bags of money. I had a rationing card the day that I got there. Organized crime, a currency that's worthless, a tax system where if you follow it, you pay 110% of revenue in taxes if you stay legal. And in spite of all that, they're building businesses and economies, right? And one thing I observed in my travels was the United States is the only place in the world where the entrepreneur is a folk hero. You know, if you're entrepreneurial here, if you're not entrepreneurial, there's something wrong with you, sometimes to a detriment, I think. You go to other countries, you speak their other languages. The word entrepreneur, enterprising, is almost something like a shell game artist, right? So it's something that separates us as Americans, I think, from most other societies. Come back to Startup Lounge. Why Startup Lounge and why here in Atlanta? I moved down here 7 years ago and discovered to my shock that there's an enormous entrepreneurial community here. I mean, everybody thinks it's an airport, Coca-Cola, and the Braves, basically. And I meet all these companies that are wanting to get going, but they say you can't raise money. And then I discovered, talking to people who had money, well, we have money, we can't find deals. And what do you mean you can't find deals? I just left a room full of 20 people that, you know, want financing. And long story short was that we discovered with my co-founder and very good friend Scott Burkett that the Atlanta ecosystem in the mid part of the last decade seemed to do everything it could actively to prevent innovation-driven entrepreneurship. And so we created Startup Lounge as an alternative. You know, Yogi Berra once said, Mark Twain once said, everybody complains about the weather, nobody does anything about it. Mm-hmm. So Startup Lounge is basically a couple of guys getting angry and doing something about it.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, Karen, what about you? I mean, you were with these big companies. We talked about that. So that's a pretty big culture shift. for you really to move to this interest in these early stage technology companies? What kind of drew you there?
I think a couple things. I think, as Mike said earlier, you want to make a difference. You want to make an impact. Clearly, the folk heroes, those are the days of Bill Gates, of Michael Dell, and you could look around and you say, wow, these guys are really making a difference. And it became clear to me in the mid-80s that as a female, I probably wasn't going to be running AT&T one day. But I said, I can make a difference in the lives of employees, customers, family, et cetera. So was recruited actually to run an early stage startup when I was a vice president at National Data Corporation. And the president at the time called me, Mark Bronstein, and said, hey, I've got this opportunity. Why don't you come take a look at it? And it had to do with battery charging invented by a Russian. And again, so that was my early days. But I just want to tack on something that Mike said, and I think exactly correct. That Atlanta is opportunity is so ripe for these entrepreneurs because there's excellent universities. We've got the climate's good, the cost of living is good, and the one thing that we're missing was early stage capital. And so I applaud not only Mike but some of the other folks that are starting to get involved and help to drive that early stage angel investing. I think we're going to talk a little later about it, that it should be a part of any private wealth portfolio. Because of the returns, but it's also, I think, good for the community. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head. That was my next question, Karen. You know, we did talk about at the beginning. I think a lot of times, well, many times, we have had family business owners on, and, you know, all of their wealth is completely tied up in their business. Or it may be diversified, but into some pretty traditional and not necessarily money that's working. And it has always occurred to me that family business owners could make great angel investors because, number one, they're really entrepreneurs, and angel money tends to be smart money. So it's natural that if they saw that as a way to diversify their wealth, they could be having a big impact. And secondly, you know, for some of the younger generation in a family business, many of those family businesses are pretty traditional. Right. And for the younger members of the family, perhaps being able to look at investing in a high tech and having that interest addressed for them, even while they are succeeding as the next generation in a more traditional business, could be a real win-win. So let's talk about that. Tell us a little bit about, I know that, as a matter of fact, this is something that you currently do, that you are an investor in some family business startups, and both you and your husband are angel investor, and you're also an investor in your husband's business.
Absolutely. And I think, again, as you said earlier, number one, I think it's the right thing to do. I think the more that's given to us, the more we need to give back. And one of the ways you can give back smartly is through an angel investment. I think number two is, again, family business owners, executives have an expertise that you may not get in corporate America. And I think that's the type of skill set. It's what I would call smart money, which I think, again, there's so much family business in Atlanta in the Southeast that it's really good to be able to focus that smart money onto early stage companies. And lastly, I think history has proven that the returns on venture capital in particular have far outweighed what you've seen in the traditional market. So I think it needs to be part of anyone's portfolio. My husband and I have invested primarily in women-run companies, but we've got about a half dozen angel investments right now, not including my husband's company, which is a company called Nanolumens, which is the world's largest flexible display company in the country.
Tell us a little bit about the other investments that you have, and kind of, you know, we're going to get into more, Mike, and ask you some questions about what to be looking for. But what drew you into the other five or six investments that you have?
I think a couple things. I think, number one, it was typically a space that I knew something about, an industry that either I had some experience with or I could do some research on. Most importantly, though, invested in people that either I had known, people that referred to me, which is one of the great things I think about Startup Lounge, is it's a great way to meet people in an informal setting so you can get to know not only who knows them but what their reputation is and so forth. I think the third thing is I looked for opportunities where I could make an impact, and not just from a financial perspective, but areas where I could provide some expertise, whether it might be in media, it might be in marketing, it might be in sales distribution channel. And we've tried to focus our investments in areas, again, where we can provide both money as well as expertise.
Is there some sort of like standardized methodology that you guys have in trying to select? I mean, obviously you know these people, but I would imagine there's some sort of methodology you have to determine, hey, is this a sound investment for us, or How do you go about that? What does that process look like?
I think it's, again, I think Mike's the right one to ask from a valuation perspective. But what we do is, again, most of the money that I've raised as a CEO, and again, it's in excess of $70, $75 million, the majority of that was, in fact, angel investment. So I've become very comfortable and familiar with looking at the business model, looking at the revenue, the financial model, and determining from that what do I think is a good return. Then on top of that, I look at how much money is needed overall, and if, in fact, we can't provide the follow-on rounds, I ensure that I've thought through who else we can get that follow-on rounds. Again, the other thing I look at is from a diversification perspective. But in the end result, I can tell you about all the fancy models, but in the end result, it's a feeling, a gut feeling we have about the management team, the space, and the opportunity.
Michael, you know, you're in Startup Lounge and you're talking to folks who are looking for angel investors. How would you describe the ideal angel investor, that person's profile, and then the ideal role that they play within those companies?
Boy, an ideal angel investor is one, I guess, whose check doesn't bounce. That's good. One that identifies a specific and constructive role to play within the company. And sometimes that role is none. I mean, there are companies that don't necessarily need any help. Just, you know, give me the check and get out of the way, and they'll do just fine. And maybe the investor has a role to play later. You know, sometimes smart money means doing nothing money and letting letting the jockey you're backing do their thing and getting the heck out of their way. Third, I think it's really important to develop a personal relationship. I just helped a friend of mine get a term sheet. I've been mentoring for a couple of years, and the key to that angel relationship working is that they developed a real friendship. And because an angel investor relationship, in my view, is the most intimate relationship in business. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have all the documents you want. It doesn't matter. The only people who make money in a legal dispute are the attorneys. You'll spend far more than the company's actually worth. So it's investors that realize that this has to go beyond a purely financial exercise. Because quite frankly, if you look at the data, broadly, Karen's the exception, broadly the returns don't make any sense. You have to get something else out of it other than a financial return.
So if you're a family business owner sitting there thinking, God, I never thought to diversify this way, and I didn't realize there was so much going on in Atlanta. Where do they start? Startup Lounge, your organization, which you can talk a little bit about. Well, how do they get started?
More often than not, capital is going to find money, and people have their own circle of advisors. Whether you're Karen, whether you're LeBron James, you sort of have this circle of people who filter stuff to you. So I think the opportunity is there. The place to start, in my view, is understanding where your comfort level is, because
right.
you will waste so much time looking at deals that may be very good, but you can't possibly do. The bite size is too big. The risk profile is no good. It's in Chattanooga, and you don't like going to Chattanooga, whatever that is. Setting specific criteria helps discipline yourself and enables your people, your network to filter deals to you in a much more efficient way.
And if I can just add on that one, I think one of the key things that I see when deals go right, one of the big differences is the expectations between the investors and the management team is in sync. The quickest way to have a deal go bad is if, again, the investor wants to look at his part-time job and the management team wants dumb money. So, again, one of the things that before you even sit down, as Mike said, before you even sit down and think about how much money you want to put at, you need to think about what role you want to play and make sure up front that though you set those expectations clearly out with the management team and the other investors, because that to me is one of the key things that that goes sideways.
I can see that consistently being an issue, because anybody that's financing stuff is going to want the control in any family business, and that's a key issue we're always dealing with: who has the control, right. and then who's actually making the money.
Exactly. Well, and I guess what I heard from you, Michael, is, you know, your trusted advisors will be bringing you this, but I think a lot of here's what's happened for a lot of family business owners up until this moment in time was real estate was their biggest idea of diversification. Mm-hmm. So they had people bringing them real estate deals, but I guess a big part of our emphasis today is to open people's eyes to, you know, you need to reach out to your trusted advisors and say, I'm willing to open this a little bit further and so ask those folks to be presenting these kinds of deals.
It certainly helps to let people know you're open for business.
Yeah. And I would suggest the other thing is think about what else you're looking to get from that relationship, because so many of the angel investors and many of my investors have invested in numerous companies with me. And the one thing that they've said is the return is very, very important, Karen, but it also to be able to watch a company grow, to know that I had some impact on helping this company grow, helping the jobs, is really meaningful to me. And I don't get that from some of my other avenues of investment.
Well, and stop me if I'm wrong, but it would appear that if I have a fourth generation sitting in the wings waiting to take over, and I maybe know I have 15 years to sit back there and wait to take over a family business, but we as a family invest in a startup technology which might just grab the interest of that younger generation, it also gives that younger generation a little bit of grooming. If they select the right investment, they get a little grooming on growing a business, even if it's a way to segue back into theirs.
Absolutely. But again, the key there is make sure that they're in sync mm-hmm. with the expectations of management team. But I think that's a great idea. There's a tremendous amount of expertise and knowledge that can be shared with the management team.
Mm-hmm. But there's a shift, though, too. I think we have to remember if you have a family business that's doing that, you have to know the culture is going to be vastly different if you're investing in a group of people that aren't family members. Mm-hmm. And I think, to your point, Karen, really understanding that dynamic and having it written down in stone is very important.
But to that point, there could be some pretty good synergy if, which I know you've done, if I am in a family business and I find a startup that is started by a couple or a family-owned startup, now I can bring them some of the road bumps that they're going to hit 5 years down the road.
Well, yeah. Let's also remember, from a tax perspective, that investment process can be an excellent vehicle, because remember, if you just give a gift, right, the first $1 million is free and the rest you're paying as of January 1st of next year 45% on. Mm-hmm. But if you are buying equity in a company, in an LLC, that's not a gift anymore. That's considered an actual investment. So it could actually, if the next generation doesn't have an interest in your business and you want to transfer wealth, that's a very tax-efficient way to do it, and it's an advantage that family businesses may have that others do not.
Yeah, I think people probably just moved a little closer to the Internet to hear that story. That's really great. Well, you know, we've talked now about diversifying wealth, and there are some family businesses sitting here now, to Meredith's introduction point, went to the banks, they can't get the money. The private equity would be happy to give them the money as long as they'd give them the control. So let's talk about private or angel investors as an option for a family business that's looking to, in a startup or early stage, looking to get some capital, and talk about what that looks like. Karen, you've been there, done that. So what does that look like?
I think a couple things. I think one of the key things that as a business owner that you need to think about is how are you going to get money returned to the investor? And the number one question is, again, how am I going to provide some sort of liquidity event so that my investor can get their money back plus a nice return to compensate for the risk? And a lot of times family businesses may or may not have been thinking along those lines. So that's the first thing is think about, okay, if I was an investor, how would I look at this business and how would I get money out of it? Second thing is I think you need to recognize that there's going to have to be some formality that you may or may not have in the business today. That includes everything from a formal business plan, but it also includes a fully developed management team, which, again, the business may or may not have. But if you've got the plan and you've got the management team that's developed and you've got a clear path to what I'm going to call liquidity, then I think it's absolutely a source of capital. As I said earlier, of the money that I've raised, the vast majority of that has, in fact, been from angel investments. And again, I'm happy to say that most of my investors have, in fact, gotten a very good return when you look at their total, what I call Karen portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think you need to recognize, though, is be prepared that there's going to be a trade-off with some of your control. When you bring in outside shareholders, they're going to look for some rights in terms of decision-making, in terms of the things you need to review with them. And again, there's no right or wrong answer. You just need to be aware that that's something you need to think about, talk to your advisors about it, and make sure you're aware and can think through what that new structure looks like.
So where does the bank's role stop, and where does angel investing come in?
Angel investing comes in when all the banks say no. And they basically say, hell no. I mean, a bank will almost always be cheaper. They will take less time. And if you can get, any investor will tell you, if you can get money from a bank, take it. Don't let them get up from the table, sign the document.
Especially, even though it's hard to get in this cheap money day. It's, again, cheaper money than we've ever seen.
Yep.
Well, and you know, I'll bring up this private equity. Many, many of the family businesses that I've worked with have toyed with the idea of looking to a private equity investor. What about that as an option?
I think it's a great option. Now, it's important to make a distinction between private equity and venture capital.
Right, right.
Venture capital historically, and we can debate whether or not this is really the case still, but venture capital historically is about building value in businesses by encouraging innovation and growth. And private equity is really about what I call financial engineering.
Right.
It's about recapitalizing a business and making it more valuable because you're lowering the overall cost of capital. All right. Mm-hmm. So if you remember your basic finance, the higher the discount rate, the lower the value of the company because the risk is higher. So if the cost of capital is lower because the cost of debt is lower, especially because you can write off the interest, just by virtue of making that investment, the value of the company jumps. Mm-hmm. Family businesses tend to be more established, and they have a really critical element that investors look for, and that is skin in the game. Okay, in my view, the biggest reason the bubble happened at the end of the 1990s was because the founder's skin in the game was practically zero. Mm-hmm. And when times got tough for these dot-coms to all of a sudden validate the value of the eyeballs, they said, you know what? My Ferrari's already paid for. My house is already paid for. I'm going to go to college now, and they're going to give me a full scholarship because I ran a dot-com. It's now your problem. Mm-hmm. Sound familiar, in the real estate market?
Yeah, very.
Yep.
One of the things I think the comment about innovation is so right on. I am a judge and have been for a number of years for the Entrepreneur of the Year. And interesting to me, again, most of my businesses that I've been involved with are I'm not smart enough to start the business. Usually the founder or the investors or the inventor brings me in, and I could come through. I put together the business model, figure out the distribution channel, raise the money, figure out exit strategy, sell the company. And so all of my businesses have always had outside boards. But it was interesting to me these last 2 years as being a judge for Entrepreneur of the Year, the number of family-owned, in some cases multi-billion family-owned businesses, and the second, third, or fourth generation had gotten involved, had come up with a very innovative, had come up with some exciting strategies. One of the ones we were talking about earlier was, I think, Mansfield Oil. And you look at what they've done. They were one of the winners this year. And when you look at some of the creative things that they have done, it was a great opportunity to bring in angel investment or outside capital because, again, they went outside the traditional historical business that Mansfield Oil had been all about.
Mm-hmm. So if you had a sheet of paper listening to this and put on the left-hand side, what are the pluses for bringing in an angel investor, and then what's some of the downside? How would we delineate that?
Bluntly, for a lot of companies, the plus side is it's only game in town.
It's right. Money.
Right?
Right. It's green.
I mean, you raise angel capital after the three F's have been exhausted, which is friends, family, and fools.
I was about to be scared there.
It's a family show, right?
That's right.
Hey, it's another F.
Is this live? Not anymore. Once that's exhausted, those people generally are investing because they want to invest in your enrichment, not necessarily a financial return. So after that, you got to get complete strangers, and that's a whole nother ball of wax. But angel investor is critical to bridging that gap between when a company is at that innovation, haven't proven anything yet phase, but I'm getting somebody to drink my Kool-Aid, versus a bank where it says, I don't need to drink the Kool-Aid. I've got assets I can attach.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it really is that it's gap financing.
Mm-hmm. But what about the plus side of, Karen, you're talking about the role that you play. You bring sales expertise. You bring some certainly distribution. I mean, it touched every piece of a business. Your banker doesn't, to your point, the banker doesn't bring that. Is that a plus side?
I think in many cases, as long as the expectations are aligned and the perceptions are aligned, I think that's one additional reason. Again, you've got to be very careful, though, what you're looking for, because if, in fact, you have one expectation and the angel investor is thinking they're going to be much more involved, it can be a real clash. And you're not going to have that clash with the banker. But I agree. That's one of the key reasons why I do invest, is not only for the financial reasons, but because I think there's some expertise that I can provide.
How do you manage those expectations? I mean, is it a contractual deal? And how do you monitor that if something really isn't going according to plan for the investor? I mean, how do you pull your money out if you're in a bad situation?
Well, that's, again, as angel investors, one of the downsides that unless that typically there's not – the angel investor cannot get their money out unless the company's doing well, and then you probably don't want your money out.
Right.
I think a couple things. I've seen it done in contractually, but I think more likely it's, again, what I call the come to Jesus meeting, which is you sit down and say, really and truly, what are you looking for? Mm-hmm. What are you looking for me to bring to the table? Let's define that. And then I would actually do some sort of a trial period. I'd watch, as Mike said, I'd watch the company for a period of time and see, do they really just want my money or do they really want my expertise? Again, there's no right or wrong answer. Just the issue is it has to be openly discussed and you need to come to some sort of agreement.
Mm-hmm. You have to embrace conflict.
Yeah.
You know, one of the worst things you can do in venture and angel investing is be passive aggressive.
I agree.
Because then you just absolutely slide off the abyss. You've got to have those come to Jesus meetings early and often.
Right.
Well, we had a show on about 2 weeks ago that talked about how much family business owners hate conflict and avoid it like the plague. So that's a really important distinction for somebody to be able to look at themselves in the mirror and decide whether they have that. So maybe on the plus side, would it be also you talked about if you're going to put angel money in, they're going to demand some outside influence. There's going to be a board of some sort typically required. Is that true?
Absolutely. And again, I think that's healthy. I just started a nonprofit myself about 2 months ago called Atlantic Council of Directors, and it's actually the first time we'll be announcing it. But the whole idea was, in fact, we're looking for an executive director as we speak, but the whole idea behind this was, again, so many privately held companies, including family-owned businesses, don't have an outside board. And so what often, when the economy's good, everybody is rocking and rolling and, you know, things are great. But the problem is when you have a downturn like we've had and we're still in the midst of, quite often they're too entrenched in the day-to-day to be able to look the 30,000 foot. Again, a great board will help you look, get above the weeds, if you will. And so one of the things we've done through Atlantic Council of Directors is we've put together executive talent, if you will, who are prepared to donate their time to privately held mid-cap companies that are looking to grow without giving up the equity. And the idea is, again, just like gap funding, we think this is a gap board. It's an opportunity to get some board expertise to look at the challenges and provide advisory services, but in a nonprofit fashion.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about your own contact at the end of the show, but while we're right on that topic, tell us, how would somebody, if they wanted to find out more about your new organization, how would they find it?
There'll be a pretty big publicity push in the third quarter, but at this point, give me a call or go send me an email, and I'll be more than happy to give you information. We've got great support from the community at large. And the other great thing is so many of these executives, again, these are not angel investors, but so many of these executives are looking for a way to help give back. And we felt this is a way. You know, Atlanta is unique in that in Silicon Valley, in New York, in Boston, L.A., when people are successful and make their money, they buy their house, second house, third house, but they still stay involved. And Atlanta is somewhat different. Quite often you see when people are getting ready to have their liquidity event, they move to Florida. And while we have nothing against Florida, we're missing some of that intellectual capital. So one of the things we're trying to do is get that intellectual capital back reinvested into the Atlanta area. And again, the operative word is intellectual capital. We want their money as well, but we really want their expertise. And that's one way we think we can do it. And I think a lot of these family businesses have got that expertise, and they can help provide that.
Well, not just that, and we discussed it in the show with Kirk McMillan, but the debate on, as a family business, whether they're open to outside board members,
right,
with it being not just privately held, but family privately held, and does the cost of our family business, so to speak, outweigh the the benefit of what some outsider might be able to bring in?
And I would suggest that, again, when times have been as good as they were in the early, 2003, 2007, 2008, was one thing. But now that we're in a deeper, you know, in this economic challenging times, I would suggest that having
PC of you.
economically challenging times, I do believe that having some outside expertise can help you. That again, they may not have the answers, but they can ask you the questions. And for the first time, I'm finding that so many of, again, family-owned businesses or these privately held companies are not asking the questions because they're too busy just trying to keep their head above water, get the customers, you know, mm-hmm. build the customers, collect the money. And again, now's the time when I think some great companies can be built if you've got if you're asking those tough questions.
Right. And the angel investor might force that issue. That's
absolutely.
Yeah. What about on the minus side? I mean, I heard one thing, which is, you know, you really have to think going in, I guess, when you take this money, how are you going to produce some liquidity if the next generation doesn't want to sell the business?
That's right.
What are you going to do? So that's obviously on that side. Anything else on the minus side?
Well, you know, the minus side is that everybody gets along, as Karen said, when things are going great. The dangerous thing about family businesses in particular, and this is a reason I never worked with my father, even though we're in the same industry, is that when things don't go well, those are some pretty awkward Thanksgiving dinners. They're very quiet. There's slamming of forks. There's, you know,
clearing
cranberry juice being thrown.
Back to that passive-aggressive again.
Exactly right. Boy, this turkey sure is moist. You know, and that's the danger with, you know, anytime you do business with family is that it you never leave it alone. It's mm-hmm. one thing if it's an arm's length transaction, there's a professional investor, hey, we're consenting adults, but and if things don't end badly, you may never have to see them again. When you're all sharing the last name, that dynamic is different. It has a much higher cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So we emphasize all the time on our show the idea of having, you know, kind of a team around you of trusted advisors. So what does that team look like if I am either side of this discussion? If I am a family business owner thinking about the fact that maybe I want to diversify some of the wealth and give my fourth generation who are chomping at the bit something to keep them busy for a few years while I finish running the company. Or on the other side where, you know, we really do fit the mold of what you're describing for angel investor. Who do they gather around them? What does that team look like for them to have the right advisory group helping them?
I think one of the things that's very important is that too often when I do see either family businesses or I see closely held companies, if they do have a board, it's their lawyer and their accountant. And, again, it's important to distinguish those folks work for you. Mm-hmm. People that work for you are not necessarily the ones that are going to give you the best advice or ask the tough questions. So I think when you're thinking about taking an angel investment or growing the company or even in these challenging economic times, I think there's so much value in getting folks that, again, from an accounting perspective or from a legal perspective, but also from a sales perspective, a strategy perspective, folks that are maybe in some industries that are complementary. But don't limit it to people that I consider on your payroll, because those folks, I would suggest, have an agenda that may not be exactly the same as yours.
So somebody that will challenge you.
Absolutely.
The best advisors are people who have been in that seat before.
Yes.
And as Karen alluded to, one of the neat things that has changed in Atlanta in the last 5 years is that successful entrepreneurs and investors have re-engaged in the community. They really disappeared. Mm. For a lot of reasons, not the least of which is, oh, you had a $20 million exit. Well, you can be the keynote speaker for every organization in town. We'll give you a victory lap.
Mm-hmm.
you know, what? You had a $100 million exit in 1999. Well, great. So did a lot of people. It's a different environment. Nowadays, the platforms are out there, and Startup Lounge is one of them, but there are many others. Startup Riot, Startup Chicks, Startup Drinks, the newly reinvented ATDC, Tag is becoming much more friendly, et cetera. You know, the environment has changed now, whereas before the investors and successful entrepreneurs, and Karen, I'm sure, can tell you a million war stories about this, they become targets.
Mm-hmm.
And they become targets because they've got money and they might need services, and they have yahoos like me stuffing business cards in their pockets all day long, you know, saying, can I possibly get 5 minutes of your time, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Yogi Berra said, they got so crowded nobody goes there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really disappeared, and so we've had safe platforms. So that's a long preamble to answering your question in that there are now angel investor groups such as the Atlanta Technology Angels. They were dysfunctional, in my view, for a large number of years.
Great new leadership.
Badly discredited for a number of years to the point where they weren't seeing deal flow. They're re-energized. That's a great place to learn from other angel investors. The Serif Group, another group that's active in town. They're actually based out of California. They have an office here in Atlanta. It's a peer investing group. Savannah Aerial Angel Partners, and also the newly forming Georgia Angel Investor Network. Those are great places. Startup Lounge has a monthly luncheon called Angel Lounge, which is a group, and Karen's been to these, so she can tell you what she thinks of it. But it's a free lunch that we offer to angel investors, and there's a mix of old, experienced investors and new investors. People may have never made an investment yet. Mm-hmm. And the thing about angel investing is that, you know, it ain't easy. Right. Even if you successfully built your own business, it ain't easy. Mm-hmm. And the biggies in our market, the Sig Mosleys, the Stephen Flemings, the Charlie Paparellis, they've all lost their share of money, believe me. but they love getting out there and sharing their war stories so you can learn from their mistakes. And also sometimes you have the opportunity to piggyback on their investments so that you learn by doing. And instead of paying a tuition of $500,000 on a bad investment in like a Slurpee machine factory, you have an opportunity to make better investments alongside people that really know what they're doing.
Hmm. And just to build, again, I've been going to the monthly luncheons, and I really encourage folks to get involved. Again, if you have an interest in this, you're going to meet some great folks. But the other thing, it's building the community. And I think that's the other thing we can't forget, that Atlanta, we're a fairly new community when it comes to angel investing, and I think that it's so healthy for the group to start getting together to piggyback off each other, the educational. And I think, again, I strongly recommend, if you have any interest, give Michael or myself a call. We'll tell you about it, invite you to the next one, which I think starts up in September. First Thursday of September. Please come, and you'll meet some great people. I especially want to encourage women, because I think there's usually only one or two of us there.
You're it.
So I'm actively sending out an invitation to any of you women out there that either part of family business or have an interest in angel investing. Please come with me. I'd love to have you as my guest.
Mike, you threw out an acronym, ATDC, which I've heard of. Tell our audience, that might not be familiar to everybody.
The Advanced Technology Development Center is one of the more successful incubators in the country. Ironically, here, you'd think they'd be out in California. Mm-hmm. Well, no, they're not. They just celebrated their 30th year. The most important company to come out of there was Earthlink. Mm-hmm. They are government-funded. They have a close working relationship with Georgia Tech. They have an office in Savannah now and one in Columbus as well. And they provide a centralized resource for venture building resources. Now, they've been very recently reorganized in a way that I applaud. And actually, we had their leadership on a podcast, a Startup Lounge, last year, where they talked about that in depth. But whereas they used to pick 12 or 15 companies at a time and say, these are the ones we're going to back and these are the winners we pick, they came to the realization that they're no better at picking good companies than most venture capital investors. And so their success record, frankly, was poor from a financial perspective. So they trashed that. And they said, frankly, we're going to become more like Startup Lounge. We're going to become more like Startup Chicks. And we're going to be a community center. And instead of making everybody come down to us and saying, hey, if you want our advice, you have to brave Route 400 at 7:30 in the morning, we're going to send people out to the local areas that are experts, that are our venture catalysts and our internal experts, and share that knowledge and help build a network that way. It's much more of a community platform. They're still in transition. When they complete that transition, I think they're going to be a much more powerful force for change and innovation in Georgia.
Wow. And Karen, I'm going to think that maybe you could shed a little light on Startup Chicks. You probably know that better than...
Absolutely. Jennifer Bonnet has done a fabulous job along with her colleagues. And what it is, again, they recognize that while there was a lot of activity with ATDC, with Startup Lounge, et cetera, it was still primarily dominated by males. And so Jennifer and a few of her colleagues put together Startup Chicks. And what we've done is it's targeted at women who are starting what should be venture-backed companies. There's a group of about a half dozen advisors that have all been successful serial entrepreneurs. And we provide everything from coaching. We have done judging. We've helped them on their elevator pitch. We've made introductions. And we've actually invested in a couple of the companies as Startup Chick members. And again, I think this just reinforces, I think, a movement that Michael's really one of the leaders of a couple years ago, which is that we've got to build this community. We've got to help these startup. And again, I love the picture of the chicks. You know, you've got the startup chicks, and you've got this idea that you've got to surround them with some love and attention. And I think whether the ATDC, through Startup Lounge, through a number of these other groups, we're providing the education, we're providing the mentors. There's a number of different judging business plan competitions, judging that, again, matches up these promising early stage companies with established mentors, and I think that's going to help continue to bring the financial and, again, ultimately going to result in a healthier, more vibrant community.
Well, so first of all, it sounds like there is an abundance of resources. So if our family business owners are sitting there and listening to this and thinking about it from either end of the spectrum, as we described, there seems to be an abundance of ways for them to get educated that they probably weren't aware of. But as I listen to you, it also seems like it's a great way to get, you know, such a win-win. If you invest in one of these companies as a family business owner, you are going to be exposed to learning some things that might turn around and come back to your business, which is probably functioning pretty traditional and hasn't embraced some of the things that these startup companies have. Mike, you and I have talked about the need to bootstrap, and, you know, family business owners are great at bootstrapping, so they can bring that to the table because they really know that. They do things more without money than with, so just great synergy between these two.
I think the other great thing is there's so much energy when you go to any of these events. It's not just energy from the 20-year-olds, but you see just this excitement and this enthusiasm. The new technologies. I've learned so much about some of the latest technology. And again, I'm not even going to name any because I'll show my age. Mm-hmm. But suffice to say that, again, just being there, I think, is going to get you energized and probably open up some ideas for you on how you might be better using technology for your own family business. Yeah,
exactly. Not the least of which, by the way, I'd say is social networking. You know,
yes.
We get at Startup Lounge, I think, disproportionate credit for democratizing the innovation venture community. Social networking is where it's really been
Absolutely.
At. You know, I tell people, if you want to learn about the community, go onto the blogosphere. There are about 10 blogs that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, have a Twitter account.
Right.
You know, make sure your LinkedIn and Facebook are active. That's where it's all at now. Maybe even Foursquare.
Foursquare.
I'm a Foursquare.
Right. Foursquare.
I'm the mayor here now.
You are.
There you go.
I didn't even notice the sash, Your Excellency.
Thank you.
Well, you know, great information, and hopefully, you know, a big objective today was to draw on your great expertise, but also to open up the minds of our listeners, because I think that there is so much to be gained from the things that we've talked about today, and not the least of which I happen to be, we've talked about so much on the show, a student of multi-generation. So I think that this brings a new dimension to looking at that in a family business. This is a point in the show where we like to leave our listeners with you know, a few tips, two or three tips that we can offer up to them as they think about this topic. Mike, what would you offer as your words of wisdom?
First is, I know a number of angel investors that are now looking at this as an alternative to conventional investing. I know multiple investors that are either expanding their investments or they're getting in for the first time because they've lost faith in Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like they're lied to. They don't understand the accounting pronouncements anymore, and I'm part of the fault for that because of fair value accounting. But they're just and frankly, the S&P 500's return has stunk the last 10 years. You know, you get zero return. Well, you can put it under your mattress for that without a brokerage fee. So, you know, consider this as part of an overall investment portfolio. Second, don't do it alone. You know, the days of being sort of isolated off in a desert or on the island as an angel investor are gone. We have a very active community of investors. We have 130 in the Angel Lounge community alone, and I think that scratches the surface. And third, invest in something you either know a lot about or have a passion about that you will become an expert of. Be a student. Learn more all you can, because while your investee target is busy executing, they don't have time to read books. you do. That's where you can add a lot of the value.
And I hate to say ditto, but those were so much of my thoughts as well. And just to reiterate two of them, again, I think it absolutely from your own personal family wealth should be part of anybody's portfolio. I think you need to look at it, and I think Atlanta is a great place because we don't have so much competition. I think quite often, again, you can get there's some very attractive deals. I think I don't want to miss out on the importance of talking about this building the community, because I think, again, Atlanta is poised to really take a leadership position, but it's going to require us to continue to spur this innovation that we have great university systems, but we need to help build great companies. And to do that, we need both, again, intellectual capital, but we also need financial capital. We need to be able to put our money where our mouth is and support some of these early stage companies. And lastly, it can be a lot of fun. I think that most people, even if they've lost money, most people will tell you who are angel investors say, I really enjoyed it. It was fun. I enjoyed meeting the team. I enjoyed being involved. It's great to be part of an early stage and to be part of this movement. So, again, I support what Michael said, and I think it's a time's now, especially with the markets where they're at. Time is now.
Going cheap.
That's great, guys. Well, we really appreciate you guys coming today.
Yeah, I want to thank you. Mike, if they want to reach out to you, can you do me a favor? Give not only your business contact, but also information on Startup Lounge. How do they find out more about that?
Yep.
Sure. Well, Startup Lounge is more important in this context. So it's mike@startuplounge.com. The domain is simply www.startuplounge.com. And you can reach us that way. My Twitter handle is Unblakeable, and that's also my personal website. And the third Tuesday of every month, I hold office hours at Taco Mac at the Perimeter location, starting at 4 o'clock. And I sit down there and I start with a beer and some nachos and see who else joins me. And that's how I try to manage my time in terms of providing as much advice to as many entrepreneurs as I can. It's not purely a Startup Lounge exercise, so even if you're a service provider, you can show up. You won't be thrown out of there. But it's a lot of fun. So if you have a startup, maybe you're shy because you're afraid of taking, quote, too much of my valuable time. It's not. It's worthless. But that's a great way to sort of show up and meet some of the other entrepreneurs and actually some of the investors in the community.
And phone?
Oh,
that one.
Do I have a phone anymore? 770-353-8373.
Great. And Karen?
I think there's a couple ways. Number one is that my email is krobinson@ata-6.com. Phone number is 770-329-3630. You can also reach me from my husband's company at krobinson@nanolumens, nanolumens.com. Again, some exciting technology that's here in Atlanta. And again, I'm a big believer in homegrown technologies, especially that have worldwide implications. And lastly, as I said, we are launching Atlanta Council of Directors, which is an opportunity, again, building community, putting together board members, experienced talent with in a nonprofit setting with privately held companies. If you're interested in either being a board member and offering some of your services, and or a company that's looking for, again, phenomenal board talent, please give me a call or an email at krobinson@ata-6.com.
Excellent. And our listeners, you can find, first of all, right now on our website, which is www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. If you go there, you will find the bios of our guest and contact information and links to various sites and connections to them. And on by about midday Tuesday of next week, you will find a transcript or a summary of our discussion, and the podcast will be up on our website. You'll be able to download it. And, you know, throughout the broadcast today, we mentioned other shows that we have had. So I urge you to go to our website with the rest of our community, and on the left-hand side, you'll see our archives. And there's many, many programs that kind of dovetail back into what we've discussed today. So thank you guys for contributing to our community.
Thanks for having us, and I'm very sorry about what I'm doing to your listener base.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, you guys, for what you're doing.
Thank you.
We'll see everybody next week.